You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Delaney.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Martin, what do you have for us?
Well, we are going to be looking at the South African situation and the African National Congress as they come up to elections next year. Can they hold their alliance together?
More from Martin in just a moment. Also on the program, EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton chairs the meeting of the Prime Ministers of Kosovo and Serbia. Are we finally seeing the goal of normalization in sight?
The particular topic that's expected to come up today is looking at dismantling these parallel political structures that exist in this northern enclave in Kosovo.
We also head to Istanbul to find out how all the benign rules and regulations imposed by the government are changing the city.
It's not about making the urban life better, but it is another social concern, making some people richer by using these laws to justify and to ease this process.
Plus, silence may be golden, but where has it gone? We hear what can be done to rescue films from the golden and silent age of cinema. Research suggests most of them may be lost forever.
And we'll also play some heartfelt music, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Thursday edition of the program, but before we get started, here is Barney Burnham with the latest news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The US Vice President Joe Biden has again questioned Beijing's recent announcement of an air defense identification zone over the East China Sea. Addressing US businessmen in Beijing on the second day of his visit to China, Mr. Biden said he'd expressed his concerns about the issue in talks with Chinese leaders.
China's recent and sudden announcement of the establishment of a new air defense identification zone has, to state the obvious, caused significant apprehension in the region. And I was very direct about our firm position and our expectations in my conversations with President Xi. The United States has a profound stake in what happens here because we need and we are and will remain a Pacific power, diplomatically, economically, and militarily.
Mexico's National Nuclear Safety Commission says police have found dangerous radioactive medical materials stolen by thieves that the United Nations said could provide an ingredient for a dirty bomb. A truck carrying Cobalt 60 was stolen on Monday while it was on its way from a hospital in the northern city of Tijuana to a radioactive waste storage center. It was found on Wednesday close to where it had been stolen outside Mexico City. The thieves removed the radioactive material from a protective case, exposing themselves to dangerous levels of radiation. They then dumped it less than a mile away. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is due to hold talks later with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. He's trying to broker a step forward in the peace process after a series of setbacks. Mr. Kerry is hoping to salvage talks brokered by the U.S., which analysts say are faltering. Israeli Government Minister Silvan Shalom says if there's to be any progress, the Palestinians must make concessions.
Israel is willing to move forward. The question is the Palestinians are willing to make the same move forward. We are not going to take any move forward without getting the recognition of the Palestinians on Israel as a Jewish state, and something that should be done immediately, and the sooner the better.
A new Amnesty International report out today includes satellite images which show the vast scale of North Korea's repressive political prison camps and the ongoing development of two of the sites in the remote north of the country. Detailed images from the two camps show new housing blocks and guard posts. Amnesty says close examination of the images shows an increase in logging and manufacturing, implying the use of forced labour. Rajiv Narayan is an East Asia researcher with Amnesty.
Prison camps in North Korea are a vital part of this vast infrastructure of repression that the North Korean government maintains to maintain its control over its population. As far as we know, there are four political prison camps in remote areas. they're vast. For instance, our satellite images show the largest political prison camp is about 560 square kilometers.
A Jordanian journalist held hostage by militants in the Philippines for 18 months has been freed. Bakir Atiani, who works for Al Arabiya, was abducted by the Al-Qaeda-linked Abu Sayyaf in the southern island of Sulu when he went to interview them in June last year. He's known for having interviewed Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan a few months before the September 11, 2001 attacks. Philippine officials say his captors released him, but Atiani says he escaped when they were distracted.
This is the feeling that I have really lost for the last 18 months. And I thank all those who really supported me, supported my case, either in the social networks, by a prayer, whatever they have done. I really thank them all, and I am back.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Many thanks indeed, Barney. Barney Burnham there with the news. It's 17.06 in Tokyo, 10.06 in Helsinki, and just gone 8.06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with some of the stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. And joining us this morning in the studio is Martin Plaut, former Africa editor for the BBC World Service and a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Welcome to the program, Martin. Shall we begin in Africa? Some unraveling fortunes, perhaps, if you look into your crystal ball. What does it tell us about the ANC?
Well, the ANC is facing elections next year, and they are worried. They're really worried because the alliance on which the whole of the ANC bases itself, which brings in the trade unions on the one hand, the Communist Party, and themselves, they lead it, is looking increasingly shaky. It was the foundation of their attack against apartheid until it was overthrown and ended in 1991. But now this structure, which has held them in power really for the last 20 years, is beginning to look shaky. The unions are saying, why should we go along it when we get so little out of it?
We can go more into the detail in a minute of why they're falling out with each other. But the ANC got 2/3 of the votes at the last election. That doesn't seem like a position from which you should be particularly concerned.
Indeed, and they will certainly win next year's election. I think there's no doubt about that. The problem for the ANC is that they're beginning to crack, and they see the slide is taking place. Partly it has been tribal. Frankly, it is now much more dominated by Zulus under Jacob Zuma. People like the Causes are very unhappy about this. And partly it is just that people have begun to get sick of them, quite frankly, after 20 years of being ruled by one single party. I mean, let me be clear. I'm 63, and in my whole lifetime, there's only been one political change in South Africa. It's a very weak democratic structure. It's not really. Everybody sits in power forever and ever. Now, the ANC thinks that it must retain its 2/3 majority at the next election, and that is beginning to look fragile. It won't lose the election, but it could slip below the 60% mark. And for them, that would be a crisis.
Why hasn't there been, a realistic alternative to the ANC in the last 20 years? You know, especially we've seen worsening economic conditions on the ground, rising racial tensions in the past few years, this division between the unions and the politicians and the people. Why hasn't someone created a feasible alternative?
Well, some people would say there are.
But no one's voting for them.
Well, the problem is there are 180 registered parties in South Africa. Some of them are tiny fragments of parties. You know, they're getting a few thousand votes. But the major opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, has grown from 1.7% of the vote to around 27% of the vote. It is rising, but it still has the problem that it is basically a white party. It was a liberal party, it was opposed to apartheid, but it was a liberal party and it is seen as too white. Now they're trying to, shall we say, blacken their image, in other words, bring more black people into the leadership structure. Can they do it fast enough? Probably not. But they are beginning to take more control at local level. And the great fear for the African National Congress is the DA already controls the Western Cape. They are frightened that it will take the area around Johannesburg. That is a possibility.
Just going back into the detail of the crumbling of this tripartite alliance with the Communist Party and the trade union movement, there's been some suggestions that those two feel that the ANC is now a capitalist party, and this is why things are getting a bit grumpy among this alliance.
Oh, it's worse than that. It's rather that the unions allege that the communists have gone into government and gone soft and have become capitalists themselves. And the Communist Party turns around to the unions and say, you're just becoming trendy lefties, so to speak, and that you don't know how to run anything, you are absolutely hopeless. And it's become really, really toxic because the unions and the Communist Party are now trading allegations of personal wealth accumulation by people in both organizations. And when you get down to the personal level, it becomes toxic.
Martin, I just found something you said quite interesting there when you were talking about the opposition being a bit too white and they're trying to blacken their image, so to speak. It seems that the race issue, of course, still plays a huge part in politics and society in South Africa. No surprise there. But do you see a figure that perhaps is emerging that could potentially bring the two sides back together again?
Not really, and that is the big problem. I mean, in a sense, people could unite when you had apartheid as the opposition. But once apartheid is gone, then you get down to the nitty-gritty, which is always money. And the question is, how should you divide the cake? And the problem is that the whites have too much of it and blacks don't have enough of it. Now, do you then use quotas to get blacks into positions for which, frankly, some of them are not ready? And, you know, there's a lot of concern, especially if you're a young white kid, you just cannot get a job in government. Now, all these problems, pile up and everybody has a huge chip on their shoulders, whether you're black, white or coloured. And that is the problem.
Now, moving on to a different part of Africa, Sudan, it desperately needs a polio vaccination campaign. Is it going to get it?
Well, the problem is really in the two states of South Kordofan and Blue Nile. There is a civil war there, a war between, frankly, Africans and Arabs. It's not a religious war. Everyone's a Muslim. But these areas have been impassable for many years now. And the difficulty is that there are a pocket of children, something like 165,000 children, who cannot be vaccinated. It is absolutely vital that UNICEF, the Children's Fund for the United Nations, gets in there and is able to distribute it. But because of the civil war, they have been held up. And there are talks coming up in Addis Ababa in the next week. And the hope is that there'll be a breakthrough and allow some peace to be established, which will allow that to take place.
Do you think there will be a breakthrough in those negotiations?
It's been a long time coming. Everyone's tried. President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, the former president of South Africa, he is trying to mediate the talks. Will he succeed? It's going to be a tough one, but it is possible. I mean, there's so much at stake because don't forget in nearby Nigeria, there is polio. And if it gets into this population, it will spread like wildfire.
I mean, this is it, isn't it? That's the herd immunity effect, as they call it.
Exactly.
And they've been hoping to wipe it out completely in Africa, and yet now all of that's under threat.
Indeed. And it's the areas of the instability that are absolutely favourable to polio. So places like Afghanistan, Somalia, northern Nigeria with Boko Haram, these are the areas where the pockets of polio are resisting the attacks by the vaccination. And if only these could be broken, we could eradicate it just as we have smallpox.
Martin, let's move on to a final story which you've brought to our attention. And that, of course, is the economic situation here on the ground in Europe. We heard some good news earlier, Spain being upgraded, their credit rating upgraded to stable. I think that's some very welcome news for those individuals in Brussels who are hoping for some good news on the Eurozone crisis, but they're also hoping for some kind of an agreement when it comes to a banking union across the continent.
Well, this is something that's been coming for a long time. Let's not forget that the crisis that we are in was caused by the banks, not by the politicians. Banks have a terrible tendency. They love going towards the edge, because the closer towards the edge that you are, the more money you can make. But of course, they have tiny reserves, and they push and push and push, and finally the whole thing comes unstuck. And that is why we are in an economic crisis. Now, the question is, should Europe be able to have one system to bind and rule these banks, which in a sense rule all of our lives? And it is a very difficult issue because, of course, each country wants to regulate its banks itself, but they realize they cannot do it unless they share the power, because the banks are so multilateral. So that is the difficulty, and it looks as if that's where the negotiations are at the moment.
Is there any feeling that things need to be done in order for no bank ever to be able to say we're too big to fail? Because that was the problem last time round. They went right to the edge. They got themselves in deep trouble. They said, ha-ha, we're too big to fail. You'll have to bail us out.
Exactly. And that is one of the things that is being looked at. There are a series of issues which are being considered. One of them is how to wind up banks that are exactly too big to fail. The problem is, in a sense, that the money in the pot is only limited. The European Stability Mechanism has only, I mean, I say only, 500 billion euros in its account. Now, is that going to be big enough? We don't know. If the bank is too big, then it won't be enough. But the question is, and the Germans are particularly worried about this, how much power should they give to the European Union, and who at the end stands behind the European Union? Will it be the public? Or will it be, in a sense, these kind of funds? And where does the power lie? So it is a typical European struggle between the centre and the periphery.
That's an entertaining struggle to come for some parts of the audience, doubtless, Martin. It's Martin Plaut, former Africa editor of BBC World Service and fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be heading over to the Balkans to see whether relations between Kosovo and Serbia are finally on the up.
Stand back from your letterboxes and tone up your biceps, because the biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to hit subscribers' doormats and newsstand shelves. The December-January issue helps you bid farewell to 2013 and look over the horizon to 2014 with our soft power survey, the Monocle 100, and our travel top 50.
In the affairs section, we sit down for a series of interviews with global heavy hitters, from the President of Chile to the Australian Foreign Minister. We take a look at the Mexican President's to-do list, look at Japan's agenda for 2014, and ask 10 writers, academics and economists to give us their predictions for the year to come.
In the business section, we visit three model factories that are working inspirations for their industries. From a Schulhaus factory in Hanover, built by the early modernist Walter Gropius, to a restored Renaissance village in Umbria making knitwear, and a Japanese brand that's so transparent, its customers are invited to pitch their tents on the lawn outside. These are companies who've created beautiful, light-filled environments for their production lines and are reaping the benefits as a result.
The Monocle December-January double issue is on newsstands now.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're off to Brussels now. The European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton will be refereeing a meeting between Serbia's Prime Minister Ivica Dacic and his opposite number from Kosovo, Hashim Tači.
It is the latest step in the normalisation of relations between the two countries, and it follows the completion of local elections in Kosovo. For the first time, ethnic Serbs in the north took part, even though they still refused to recognise Kosovo's self-declared independence. Well, Guy spoke to Monocle's. Spoke to Monocle's Brussels correspondent Charlotte MacDonald Gibson and asked about the reaction there to the recent polls.
There were some very positive statements from Catherine Ashton when the final results came through just a few days ago. Obviously, the results maybe were not exactly what the EU had been hoping for. It was a Serb nationalist who won the elections in Mitrovica, but that's democracy, and the polls were considered to be free and fair. So there were some very positive statements out there, and it's really paved the way for this next round of talks and the next policy discussions which are taking place today.
I want to talk about Catherine Ashton and her role in all of this. This is something which she's put a lot of time and effort into getting the prime ministers of Kosovo and Serbia together on a regular basis and trying to come to some sort of accord on this. How important is it to her personally that this is seen to be a successful process?
Well, Catherine Ashton has been in the news a lot in the last couple of weeks because of her success in helping get the Iran deal done. But really, the Kosovo-Serbia negotiations, that was her first real success this year. And that's when people really started to say, hang on a minute, maybe we've been giving her a little bit of a hard time up until now. So yes, this deal that she struck in April was really the result of a very long, determined diplomatic push from her to get these two sides, which people thought, you know, would never come together. They thought this would never happen. But she really put in the hours and she got them both at the table and she managed to announce this deal in April. And people say it really was down to that sort of dogged determination that she managed to overcome so many problems between the two sides.
And it came together relatively quickly as well, because the government of Serbia only came into office in July last year. Negotiations in Brussels only started, I think, in October. So it was a matter of a number of months when this all came together. But understandably, that left things rather broad brush, as it were. And I believe that today's discussions chaired by Catherine Ashton with the two prime ministers are going to try and work out how they take the next steps in Kosovo to make sure that ethnic Serbs are properly represented in the Republic of Kosovo.
Yes, that's right. So each round of talks has really got down to the nitty-gritty of this deal that they struck in April. And the particular topic that's expected to come up today is looking at dismantling these parallel political structures that exist in this northern enclave in Kosovo. Essentially, Belgrade had appointed parallel justice systems and everything in this enclave where there is this majority. And part of this deal struck in April was that had to end. But exactly the nitty-gritty of how they do that needs to be agreed. And that's what they're going to be doing today, is talking about the formation of these communities of Serb municipalities and also Serb courts and also the justice system there. So it's exactly how they're going to run this enclave in northern Kosovo, when most people who live there want to be part of Serbia.
Which is a very tricky system indeed. And they were encouraged to take part in the Kosovo local elections of a country they don't recognise. And the line that they were fed by the government in Belgrade was, well, this is the only way that we can set up this association of Serb municipalities, which will allow you representation. It will allow us to continue to channel some money towards Serb communities in Kosovo. But the interesting thing is the degree to which policy in Brussels is being sorted out. How frantic are the sort of preparations for a meeting like this, where you've now got the ability to put this association into place, but you still don't know what it's going to look like?
Yes, I imagine that they're reasonably frantic, but we don't get too much of an insight into exactly what's going on from the External Action Service. I mean, that was one of the criticisms of it when it first came into being, of Catherine Ashton, is that they didn't have a huge amount of communication about what's going on. And it's certainly the case in this. I mean, exactly how they're putting together these deals, what the sort of negotiations are going on between the two sides, we don't really know about that. But what we do know is that both sides are really looking ahead to December, which is when Catherine Ashton will be putting together a report and the EU will be putting together a report to present to the European Council, which will be really crucial in terms of both Serbia's accession talks to the EU, which are expected to start in January, and further off down the line, Kosovo's potential steps towards membership as well.
And what's the feeling in Brussels about where Serbia in particular, who are much further along the process than Kosovo, what with Kosovo not being recognised by several EU member states, but Serbia's gone pretty much all in down the EU membership path. It's bet all its chips on getting these membership talks underway. Are people making positive noises in Brussels about that?
Yes, they are. I mean, the EU membership was really the carrot that was dangled to Serbia to get them to come to the table with the Kosovans and to really engage in these talks. And if you look at the conditions that are set on these accession talks, they really wanted Belgrade to get behind these local elections, and Belgrade did that. They actively tried to persuade Serbs in northern Kosovo to vote. So they have been ticking the boxes. These talks are going on, and that really is the main precondition for really starting these accession negotiations in January. Of course, once that hurdle is over, there are lots of others. There are 36 chapters, as they call them, 36 policy areas where the countries have to show real development. And these are things like rights, justice, corruption, all these sort of areas. And I'm sure once they get down to the nitty-gritty of those in Serbia, there's going to be a few more issues as well between the EU and the Serbian authorities.
That was Monocle's Brussels correspondent there, Charlotte MacDonald Gibson, speaking to Guy.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 16:25 in Singapore, 12:25 in Moscow, and 10:25 in Jerusalem. We continue our show with our daily check-in with one of our many correspondents around the world.
And today we are off to Ramallah to discuss the latest news out of Israel and the West Bank with our woman there, Marika Peters. Welcome to the program, Marika. Shall we begin? Transparency International has a list of the most corrupt countries on the planet. And where does Israel sit on that list?
Israel came 36th out of the 177 countries on that perception index, which doesn't sound that bad, but it hasn't been that well received here. Mainly, I think Israel likes to see itself as very uncorrupt, and specifically it's measuring itself against the other countries in the OECD, which is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And in that list, it came 23rd out of just over 30 countries. So that wasn't a particularly good look for Israel.
What I think is interesting with the Transparency International survey is, as you say, Marika, perceptions of corruption. And, of course, they achieve this by going around and asking people, do you think these transactions you're doing are in any way corrupt? Have you encountered corruption in your everyday life? It's not entirely scientific. So perhaps it just means that Israeli citizens have a particularly keen nose for being diddled.
Right. Well, I think that's probably fair enough, given that as we've discussed on your programs in the past, there's an awful lot of corruption here, both at kind of national government level and in local politics. You only need to look at the recent case of Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister who was accused of all sorts of corrupt practices, but actually was let off. And I think you're right. Maybe the Israelis are kind of resigned to it. I think they know that it goes on, but it's just so endemic that they're kind of they just accept it as part and parcel of living here.
And Marika, you have another list for us. We do like lists here at Midori House. This time, it's about suffering.
Well, yeah, I do. I thought I was looking out for how the Israelis were faring this week. And yes, there's another interesting story in Israel about it's a Gallup poll on suffering across the world, and Israel is ranked 109 out of 143. So that means it's the 34th happiest country in the world, according to this poll, which again I find interesting, given how many sort of problems there are in this country, really.
But again, I suppose there's a lot to be happy about. The weather's good, the produce is good. There's a lot to be happy about there as well, though, isn't there? The weather's good, the produce is good, there's a great sense of community among people.
That's true. That is true. I think there are all of those things, but what perhaps is surprising is that Israelis, sometimes I think they see themselves as suffering. There are huge economic problems here. Housing is very problematic, and of course, and after that you have all the issues to do with peace and the Palestinians. But so maybe they're not doing so badly after all.
Well, someone who perhaps isn't doing so badly when he has an ice cream in his hand is Benjamin Netanyahu. It seems that he's getting into some trouble over his desire for those delicious flavored creams.
Well, that's right, and Prime Minister Netanyahu certainly isn't suffering, if you're to believe a report on his expenses, which was out this week in response to a Freedom of Information request. This is really interesting. He cost the state of Israel nearly 3 million shekels a year, which is around $850,000. Now, this report has kind of broken down different costs, including, as you just mentioned, his ice cream bill, which is $2,500 a year, $25,000 for flowers and scented candles in his home in Jerusalem, which has largely been attributed to his wife, who also came in for quite a lot of criticism, and a very large water bill for his holiday home. That was around about $22,000 a year. So that's been very embarrassing for Netanyahu.
The only thing we need to know, Marika, is what's his favourite flavour?
It's pistachio.
Fantastic. I had him down as a pistachio man, funnily enough. I just had that feeling. So there
it's
we
the
are.
Right reason for it, isn't it?
Marika, thanks very much. We're going to have to leave it there. Marika Peters in Ramallah, thanks very much for joining us here on the programme. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll look through this morning's British front pages and we'll find out how out-of-date rules are affecting the future of Istanbul.
But first, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. The US Vice President Joe Biden has again questioned Beijing's recent announcement of an air defense identification zone over the East China Sea. Addressing US businessmen in Beijing on the second day of his visit to China, he said the announcement had caused apprehension in the region. Mexico's National Nuclear Safety Commission says police have found dangerous radioactive medical materials stolen by thieves that the United Nations said could provide an ingredient for a dirty bomb. A truck carrying cobalt-60 was stolen on Monday while it was on its way to a radioactive waste storage centre. The US Secretary of State John Kerry is due to hold talks later with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. He hopes to salvage talks brokered by the US, which analysts say are faltering. A new Amnesty International report includes satellite images which show the vast scale of North Korea's repressive political prison camps. Amnesty says close examination of the images shows an increase in logging and manufacturing, implying the use of forced labour. A Jordanian journalist held hostage by militants in the Philippines for 18 months has been freed. Bakir Atiani, who works for Al Arabiya, was abducted by an Al-Qaeda-linked group in the southern island of Sulu when he went to interview them in June last year. He's known for having interviewed Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan a few months before the September the 11th attacks in 2001. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney, we'll be back at the top of the hour, 9 o'clock in the morning here in London, for another check of your world headlines. But in the meantime, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Delaney. This week, The Urbanist is taking a look at the rules that guide our cities, from skyscraper-high scaffolding in Zurich to the shuttered shops of Paris on Sunday. They'll take a look at how the rules we set can often miss the point. But in this preview, we head to Turkey.
And we'll be asking what happens when the state imposes rules and regulations on major urban centres to establish a sense of cultural conformity. Can a prime minister operate as a mayor? In Istanbul, the Turkish government is projecting its hopes and desires on the urban landscape, and it's doing this through benign rules and regulations that use the city to establish a national identity. Monocle's Joseph Dana sent us this report on Istanbul's shifting landscape of laws.
I am now in the heart of Istanbul's Beyoğlu Quarter. The streets are narrow and lined with bars and cafes. In a few hours' time, when the sun disappears, residents and tourists alike will descend on this area of town for after-work drinks. But they will not sit down outside, because the city has removed all outdoor seating in an effort to control the amount of drinking in this neighborhood.
Well, at first, everything completely stopped. I mean, you would come down here in the middle of the night and it would look like a back street in, I don't know, in Shishli or something like that. There would be nobody out, nobody drinking.
That is New Zealand expat Ruben. For several years, he's lived in the center of Beyoğlu's nightlife area and watched the area change after the outdoor seats option disappeared.
Many of the bars dropped their prices in an attempt to win customers back, obviously, with moderate success. And then slowly over time, the region's kind of built up again. And now, you know, as in past years, there are again sort of thousands of people flocking here over the weekends. But it's a very different scene than what it used to be. It's had a negative impact for the following reason. Simply that when people come here now, they're just standing on the street drinking. They're not sitting down and eating. And there's a very different culture that goes along with that.
Increasingly, cities around the world are engaged in an unfolding dance between municipal authorities and residents over urban complexions. In Istanbul, however, the dance has national undertones. Rules and regulations dictating urban life are decided as much in Turkey's capital, Ankara, as they are in Istanbul. From the banning of outdoor cafes and bars in Beyoğlu, to the stiff regulation of alcohol, Turkey's ruling AKP party is trying to transform Turkish identity through the imposition of rules and regulations for the urban environment in Istanbul. At least according to Yaşar Adanalı, an academic and urbanist based in Istanbul.
One very local level issue is this banning street cafes in around Beyoğlu area, and that's mainly come from not because of street-related problems, but a certain society vision that doesn't really want this vibrant street life that anyone can join, a heterogeneous kind of life that people drink and talk and chat. So it's more kind of containing, controlling, disciplining the society, and that reflect into urban codes. So this cultural vision translated into an urban code. Another level would be this earthquake-related disaster law, which is supposed to be preparing the city to earthquake. But what we see for those existing urban transformation areas where the government wants to implement a for-profit projects, they use this law, the newly introduced law, to say that, well, now this area is designated as unsafe area. Hence, it should be transformed into something new. So again, you see in this case, it's not about making the urban life better, but it is another social concern, making some people richer and by using these laws to justify and to ease this process. So this is at various levels we can see that in Istanbul.
The sounds of protest in Istanbul. But this is not from last summer's Gezi Park protest, which brought urban issues to the forefront of the national agenda. This is the sound of some Istanbul residents reacting to a recent change in Turkey's alcohol laws. Earlier this year, the Turkish parliament pushed through surprise legislation that curbed the sale and consumption of alcohol in Turkey. From 10 p.m. until 6 a.m., one can no longer purchase alcohol in Turkey, and new bars are not allowed to open within 100 meters of schools and mosques. But how is this changing the urban environment? When I posed this question to various shopkeepers in Beyoğlu, they all answered that it was a very big problem, but were hesitant to speak on record, fearful of reprisal from authorities. One unforeseen consequence of the maze of rules and regulations that the Turkish government has employed to alter the urban character of Istanbul is the formation of a new legal consciousness on the local level. As the Gezi Park protests demonstrated, residents of Istanbul who are concerned about the direction of the city are prepared to take to the streets. Yaşar Adanalı, again.
In a way, people are quite adapting to this game. But at the same time, because of the nature of the game, you need to be very skillful and very knowledgeable on this particular language and how it will end up. I mean, eventually, I think it's not only about what laws and regulations and laws been introduced, but how just and what kind of impact it has is on people's lives. So this is going to be more and more what we're going to discuss, and probably these will have to be changed.
The Turkish government's plans to establish Istanbul as a city of regional and international prominence are hard to miss. Under the surface of this glossy Istanbul branding campaign, a quiet battle is forming over the character of the city. On the one side, the ruling AKP party is using the state apparatus to impose rules that influence the urban fabric of the city. They are supported by millions of AKP members that want to see a more conservative city and a more conservative country. On the other side of this dance are citizens worried that rules established in the state capital don't correspond to the needs of their city. The Gezi Park protest revealed how easy it is for these forces to take to the streets, and it is only a matter of time before they return. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
And you can hear more of this week's edition of The Urbanist, which premieres at 6 a.m. in Sydney, 1900 hours here in London, and 11 a.m. in the morning in San Francisco.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a look at what's being done to rescue silent films.
Aha.
See what I did there?
Very clever.
Research in the US suggests most of them have been lost forever.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're at 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. The guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Greetings. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 17:41 in Tokyo, 8:41 here in London. That's in the morning. And it's time to forget about the ear-shattering blockbuster films of today and instead head back to gloriously quieter times. The period up to the 1930s was known as the Golden Age of cinema, a time when black and white and silent films were the standard.
Some 11,000 movies were made during that time, but according to a report by the US Library of Congress, nearly 70% of them are either destroyed or lost altogether. Well, to find out what happened to all those films, we're now joined on the line by Brian Robinson from the British Film Institute here in London. Brian, welcome to the program. Some 11,000 films, quite a high number of these silent and black and white films, but a very startling figure, 70% of them completely destroyed.
Yes, people didn't really reckon that films were anything more than an ephemeral entertainment. They were made by mainly commercial entities, and when they were done screening them, they'd put them on the shelf, and when a company closed down, they would put them in the bin. All 35mm films at the time, up until 1950, in fact, were made of cellulose nitrate, which decomposes as soon as it's made, so it's a very unstable medium. It's also got silver in it, so people would just melt down the films to get both the silver content and the celluloid. So there's lots of great films that have been turned into combs and ashtrays and pieces of silver. But we in the BFI National Archive have over 20,000 films, the 11,000 figure that you have, that's from America. The silent films were made all over the world. They carried on making silent films up until 1936 in Japan, but they destroyed all of their original copies because the fire risk was considered so great in a country that's got so many wooden buildings. But we've got a state-of-the-art facility up in Warwickshire, a very James Bond-like lair, called the Master Film Store, and we store all of our master prints of silent and sound films at -5 degrees centigrade and 35 degrees relative humidity. But those, the 20,000 silent films that we have, they are not just British. There are films from all over the world.
Brian, there's echoes, of course, here of what's happened with television or programmes from the early days of television, where they either went out live or they were on tapes, which were then reused. So all these great programmes were wiped. And now, of course, we're realising what we've lost. The question that Phil and I were pondering, though, before you came on, was what are we missing out on if we're not watching silent films? What does that particular medium or variety of the medium give us that we don't get in other ways?
Well, just it gives you a window on a world that has vanished. The silent period in England from 1895 to 1929, there were lots of very, very adept filmmakers who told great stories, great dramas, and although they don't have spoken dialogue, they do have dialogue on intertitles, but they're very skillfully used. And if you see a good silent film, you almost feel as if you are hearing the speech. It just becomes part of the whole experience. And the funny thing about silent films is that they were never silent. They always had live musical accompaniment. So that really enhances the experience that you've got emotional mood music that lifts the spirit, and there's something wonderful about live music. But silent films are still being made. Most people will have heard of The Artist, Oscar-winning. A very good film made last year was Blanka's Nieves, a kind of Snow White. It has a kind of emotional power and depth and subtlety that you don't get with all these bangs and explosions.
And some of those films that have been lost forever include things like Cleopatra, The Great Gatsby, London After Midnight. Now, this was a three-year American study, as we were discussing, but from what I understand, there has never been a British study in a similar vein. Are there plans now to undertake such a study here in the UK?
Well, we're constantly reviewing our own collections and getting new films or new to us into the collection, and so we're actually making discoveries all the time. In the 1990s there were 820 plus short films that were discovered in a shop in Blackburn. We know that there are many films just coming to light. To be honest, most of them are not romantically in a sort of Tutankhamun's tomb or under the bed. They're often in collections and may have been miscatalogued. And the great thing about the digital era is that we're finding new ways of looking at our collections and making great discoveries.
Brian, just briefly, if there was one silent film, if people are listening to this and they're curious and they think, maybe I've been missing out all these and I should sit down and watch a silent film, which one should they go for?
The Wonderful Lie of Nina Petrovna. It stars Brigitte Helm, and she's a courtesan in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's an incredibly powerful and emotional story about a woman and the sacrifice she's willing to make for her Brigadier General.
And just give us that title again.
It's The Wonderful Lie of Nina Petrovna. But there are many, many. I'd say Anthony Asquith's Underground is also a good place to start, or A Cottage on Dartmoor, or E.A. DuPont's Piccadilly.
Well, Phil is looking those up as we speak, Brian.
It's my weekend viewing.
So thank you very much for joining us, Brian. That's Brian Robinson of the British Film Institute.
I actually did see a part of that Tutankhamun film, that black and white silent film from way back when.
And did it make the emotional connection that Brian was talking about?
Well, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I only actually watched about 10 minutes. And then I think I got distracted by something else.
In this modern iPad, tab-pressing, phone-calling world.
I think I had to do some online shopping or something.
Dear me, that's shocking, isn't
it? Well, in just a moment, we'll be looking through this morning's British front pages with Monocle's Ella John. But before we get into that, at the top of the show, Guy promised us some heartfelt music. So here it is. This is the Pet Shop Boys now with Heart. That was the very lovely song there, Heart by the Pet Shop Boys.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Guy Delaunay, and him, Phil Hahn. We continue with a look at the day's British papers. And for this, we're joined in the studio by the creator of the Inland Sea of Studio One in Midori House, Ella John.
Inland like Sea?
Well, that was what you just created on the table, there, wasn't it?
Guy, I wasn't breaking the fourth wall. No one knows.
I just spilled a small glass of water, but nothing's been damaged as yet.
No, jolly good. But you may be later.
Yeah, we'll see until Sally gets in the cleaner, that is.
We've got things to talk about,
yeah,
haven't we?
Yeah, we do. I was actually hoping to look more towards Spain than Britain. But
okay.
Does Spain have an inland sea?
Not to my knowledge. I lived there for a year. But no, it has some interesting news, though.
Jolly good. That's a great relief.
I tried my hardest to get some news from my favourite paper from when I lived there, which is La Opinión de Murcia, which unfortunately...
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, it isn't the... How can I put it? It doesn't have the most...
It's not got the profile.
It doesn't have the profile of El País or La Verdad or whatever. Mm. But yeah, and it's a regional... It's like an outpost of the country.
What do you like about it?
Why are we reading it?
We're not. That's what I'm saying. Oh. I tried my damnedest to find a good story from there. But the really interesting stories are, to be fair, in the main press today. So let's start with that. El País is looking at the anti-protest law. That is the citizen security law, as such, put together by the popular party. That's El Partido Popular. And this has caused, as you might imagine... given the way it's been termed now as the anti-protest law, received a hell of a comeback from human rights groups. Council of Europe has most recently yesterday expressed concern that the so-called offences against Spain that are to be criminalised include such things as holding placards, public acts of shouting that are supposedly harmful or abusive to Spain or any region. They can toss up you a fine of anything in the region of 1 to 30,000 euros. That's down from 600,000 for those who organise demonstrations without a permit. That was the initial proposal for the bill, which obviously, after a bit of a backlash, has been rescinded to 1,000 euro fine and 30,000 for organisation.
It just seems absolutely shocking, doesn't it? Especially in a country which is so interlinked with the protest movement, especially with the economic crisis that they've been facing over the past couple of years.
Yeah, to be honest, I've been striving to try and find the source of it, and I can't find anything beyond that the Partido Popular doesn't take well to popular protest.
Though, to be fair, The Guardian the other day was pointing out that there's a lot of this going on in various places. They made the example of Chicago, for example, where there was a supposed temporary protest law brought in, which has now turned into a permanent one, championed by Rahm Emanuel, no less. And of course, in the UK, you can no longer protest in front of Parliament. Well, not very effectively, at any rate.
Effectively, yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the niggling point here. It's what type of protest. The bill is... It has been approved on Friday, but just gone. The Interior Minister, Jorge Fernandez Diaz, he's one of the architects for the measure. He says it will be passed by the PP-controlled Congress early next year. It's Partido Popular-controlled, so the bill will be passed, unless, you know, some popular protests might
throw a spanner
in the works. Yeah, no, there is. I mean, Council of Europe, the Minister for Human Rights, his name is, where is it, Nils Muzniek. He's a Commissioner for Human Rights, at the Council. He's called the bill disproportionate. That's the key idea, the proportionate response of a government to popular protest. He says, when I see a potential fine of up to 600,000 euros for holding an unauthorised demonstration in front of a government building, I'd like someone to convince me that this is a proportionate penalty.
And the European Commission has also been giving Spain a kicking.
It has indeed. So the commits for Brussels... This is a great title as well. This is from El País. La Comisión Europea pedirá a España explicaciones sobre las cuchillas. It means, in a really bad pun, if you will, in the English title would be, Brussels has sharp words for Spain over their razor wire fence. Pretty bad taste. But yeah, so the European Commission, it's not looking favourably upon the razor wire fence that Spain has installed on the border between Morocco and its exclave of Melilla. That's, the Melilla is the little... area of North Morocco, which is actually not North Morocco, it's part of Spain. Mm. And the Commissioner for Home Affairs from the Commission, Cecilia Malmström, said on Wednesday that she's going to ask, it's the same guy again, Interior Minister Jorge Fernandez Diaz. He's not a popular man.
I'm spotting
the details of the project.
I'm spotting two problems here, though. Who's elected the Council of Europe? Who's elected the European Commission? The answer is nobody. Whereas Spain has a democratically elected government.
The problem being that they can wag their fingers. Ultimately, the Partido Popular doesn't have to do anything. I mean, Council of Europe is one thing. Commission obviously has a lot more weight. But ultimately, until a different government gets elected in, the wire fence is not going to get taken down. Interestingly, the socialist government prior to the Partido Popular did actually take the wire fence down, which had been erected by the Partido Popular. As soon as the PP come back in power, they re-erect the fence. The main problem with the fence is that it causes damage but doesn't actually prevent people to go over.
Now, Aled, one more story, and I'm going to be completely honest with you. I know you're doing well here at Monocle, but, you know, maybe there could be some better times on the horizon. And maybe this next story could fit in perfectly with you.
Are you harking back to my musical roots?
Well, yeah, exactly.
My Welsh heritage.
Madrid's looking for some street performers, and they're holding open auditions.
So this week... Thank you, Phil. I'll speak to the bosses. HR department is might have a word to say about that. So the City of Madrid has been auditioning street musicians this week. It's a new thing that's come into play in the city. You need a license to perform. Over 400 applicants in theory for the first couple of days. The criteria has not been established, but I like this a lot. You have to entertain the public, but without bothering neighbours or passers-by. You can't bother passers-by.
Well, Alan, I think you'd be a great street performer. I think all three of us would be great. We could maybe have a little...
I think it's a good philosophy band for Monocle. Entertain everybody without bothering them.
A trio.
Exactly. Thanks very much, Alid. Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, and our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luis Mendoza. And our studio manager today was Bill Luti. Up next, after the news, is The Culture Show with Robert Bound. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, 7 a.m. in New York. Tag Enright and Georgina Godwin will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Guy Delorno. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.